Okay, let's get started, please. So firstly, announcements. Next week, tutorials for this class, this course is starting. If you go to the homepage and you go to the section on tutorials, there'll be a link to a tutorials page which tells you which tutorial group you've been assigned to. So please check there and check again today just to make sure you haven't been moved around. So check there for where you should be going and when you should be going next week. Also too, for the Wednesday right now, we still have two groups which are rather large. I think they've got between 15 and 18 students in them. That's rather large for a group. And if you're in one of those groups, it won't be so great if you've got lots of other students there too, also asking questions. If you're in one of those groups and you haven't already, please let the course secretary, Kendall Reed, know about any other times you could make tutorials, make for tutorials next week. So you'll see there also the other times presented. So please let her know if one of the Tuesday or Monday tutorials would work, or maybe the Thursday afternoon tutorial would work. And that way we'll get she'll then figure out where to move some people so we get some more balanced numbers in all our tutorial groups. As I said before, we expect you to prepare for tutorials. There is a tutorial sheet up on the schedule page, which gives you a set of exercises based on what we covered in the first week on data representation. So I strongly encourage you, if you haven't already, go through that sheet, try all the questions, and come along next week to your tutorial group meeting with your questions. If you do so, you'll get lots more out of the group than otherwise. All right, any questions about tutorials? All right, so let's continue with what we were talking about on Tuesday. So if you remember, Tuesday we started talking about this MIPS instruction set. So programming in assembly language and the close relationship between assembly language and the actual machine code, the ones and zeros that actual CPUs understand. We've been through some simple classes of instructions, like we've been through looking at arithmetic instructions, so add and subtract and logical bitwise operations. And now today, we're going to continue and look through some further classes of instructions and look at the translation from some simple Java code or C code, which is very much like Java, look at the translation from that into equivalent assembly language. And we'll look again too at how you go from the assembly language itself to machine code. So we ended last week talking about these load and store instructions. So load word, load byte, store byte. Associated with these instructions, there's just a kind of topic I wanted to cover with you called endianness, whether data stored in a big endian fashion or a little endian fashion. So let me explain what I mean by that. So I've drawn these, I've got a slide here which has got some information. I've got some pictures on the board too, which will present an alternative explanation, but it's the same concept being explained. The issue is this, that when we look at our picture of memory is byte addressable. So memory we can think of as being a huge array of bytes. Here's the index of the bytes. Each of these locations is just 8 bits, and we've got them numbered, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, upwards. So memory is byte addressable, but if, say, we've got a 32-bit processor, we're really working with data in 32-bit chunks, 4-byte chunks at a time. So here's a word, here's a 4-byte chunk of data. Conventionally, as before, we have the most significant bit down this end and the least significant bit down this end. Let's give the bytes names. Let's call them byte 3, byte 2, byte 1, and byte 0. So if we've got this 4-byte word here, am I writing big enough for you at the back there, or should I? Is it okay? If you've got this 4-byte word here, there's a question now of how we can store that byte in memory which is arranged like that. And it's a choice of really which of these bytes, which of these 4 bytes, which of these 4 bytes do we put at the bottom, and then, so do we take these 4 bytes and kind of put them in like that, or do we take them like that and kind of put them in like that? So does this byte here, the least significant byte, does that go, if say we want to use up these 4 locations here, do we put this byte here, or do we put it here? And it's a choice that you have to make as a CPU computer architecture designer. And historically, both decisions have been made, which has caused huge confusion sometimes. For example, that people designed memory systems to work with one convention, but then somebody's wanted to use a CPU with the other convention, and they've had to actually swap around the orders of bytes on the fly, which has been a real mess in hardware. So, yeah, if I was to draw kind of arrows, one pitch would be going like this. So we put byte 0 at the bottom, byte 1 above it. So byte 0, byte 1, byte 2, and byte 3. So byte 3 has gone there. So this approach is called a little endian approach. Little endian, because this is the little end of this 4-byte word. And the little endian is kind of going in first. It's going in at the lowest address. So this is the little endian approach. Conversely, so now over here, let's look at the other approach. So again, we've got a 4-byte word. The big endian approach says, well, let's put the most significant byte, this byte 3, in at the bottom. So here, byte 3 goes there, byte 2 goes there, byte 1 goes there, byte 0 goes there. So this is the big endian approach. There's then the bottom of this slide is just a different presentation of what I've shown you here on the board. There's another question too, it's this question in the second bullet there of what we call alignment. So we've got this memory addressed in bytes up here. And the question is, if we're storing a 4-byte word, how can we position it in memory? Do we have to position it so that it fits kind of into a chunk of 4 bytes there, or could we position it like that? Or like that, starting at byte, say, could we put this word in from byte 2 up to byte 5? And the language we use, we say that when we kind of put, say, a word into memory so that it's, say, it's a 4-byte word, if we put the 4-byte word into memory on a boundary, where it starts at a location which is a multiple of 4, then we say that the data storage is being aligned. It's aligned with these kind of natural boundaries, the natural way in which we break up this memory into 4-byte chunks. On the other hand, if we store a word, say, so that goes from here, goes in these 4 locations, so it goes here, we would say that the storage of that word is non-aligned. And so here we're talking about alignment of 4-byte words. You can also talk about alignment of 8-byte words or 2-byte words as well. And it's a very similar concept, this idea. If we're talking about 8-byte words, then the alignment would be on some boundary which is a multiple of 8, and so on. So these are kind of this concept of big endian, small endian, and this concept of alignment are both important concepts to understand and appreciate. Any questions on this? All right, let's move on. All right, so we saw last time some assembly language for simple instructions. In this slide, we'll look a bit about how we actually store those, represent those instructions using binary words, using 32 bits, 32 ones and zeros. And so, for example, we have, for a start, what are called R format, register format instructions. So these are all the instructions which work purely in registers. So they take two things out of two registers, say, and they put the result back into a third register. For example, the add instruction, or subtract instruction, or the AND instruction, which does a bitwise AND. So what we have, what we see here, is we see the 32 bits broken up into different fields. For the register format instructions, the first 6 bits and the last 6 bits down here tell you which instruction to execute, tell you whether it's an add or subtract or an AND or an OR. Then you've got a sequence of 3 5-bit fields. So remember, there are 32 registers in MIPS, so you need 5 bits to name a register or to give the number of a register. So we've got 3 5-bit fields, 2 giving the 2 operands, the 2 arguments to the operation, or giving which registers to take those arguments from, and a 3rd 5-bit field telling you where to store the result of that operation. These additional 5 bits down here are used for these shift instructions. So if you remember this logical shift right and left, shift right and left instructions, took an argument which told you how many bits you want to shift to the right or how many you want to shift to the left. When you use those instructions, the instruction only takes one argument, so you ignore the second operand, but instead you use this field down here to specify how much the shift should be, how many bits you're shifting to the right or the left. And again, because we could shift up to 31 places, we use 5 bits, we need 5 bits to specify that shift amount. So this is how we kind of use a single 32-bit word to talk about all these R format instructions. So one very nice thing in general about, you'll find with a RISC architecture, is virtually every instruction can be expressed in just a single word. So every instruction is the same size. If you go to complex instruction architectures, you find sometimes that there are instructions with multiple words. And the fact that you've got variable size instructions just complicates all the hardware. So again, this is one way in which the RISC architecture simplifies things. It has a uniform, simple, small size for all instructions. At the bottom here, we've got another example of an instruction format. This is the I format. Do I remember what I stands for? I stands for, of course, it's in slide, immediate. So this format's used for instructions like add immediate. So in that, with an add immediate instruction, you have one register that you take data out of. That's this first operand here. You've got another place that you put the data after you've done the addition, which is specified here. And then you've got 16 bits to specify a number which is a signed number, which is added or subtracted to the value taken from the operand register here. So also these instructions like we looked at OR immediate uses the same kind of format. So again, we've got here, we just use 6 bits at the top here to specify which of the instructions we actually are intending with the sequence of bits. So that's the second format. And you can, if you look in the documentation that I point you to in the lab, or you look in the back of this Hennessy and Patterson book, you'll see a whole appendix which talks more in detail about the other formats of instructions and explains how they too are laid out in different fields, or how they use different fields of these 32-bit words. All right, let's move on now to another class of instructions. Here we're looking at how, next couple of slides, we'll look at how we implement control flows. So in a high-level language like Java or C, you've got if-then-else statements, you've got while loops, you've got method or function calls and return statements at the end of functions. So we're going to look at how all those features in a high-level language are realized in assembly language, essentially in machine language. Let's start with looking at a conditional statement. So, for example, in Java, an if-then-else statement. So here, you all know, this says if it does the if statement does a test of some Boolean condition here, if this condition turns out to be true, then the statement or group of statements here are executed. If the Boolean expression here turns out to be false, then instead the ones here are executed. And in either case, after we've finished the instruction, after we've finished the if case or the else case, we come down here and we execute the following statement or group of statements. So you're all familiar with that control flow for what happens in Java. Let's see how we implement this, how we realize it in the MIPS instruction set. For a start, we use an instruction called, or we can use an instruction here called BEQ. This stands for branch if equal. It takes the names of two registers, and it takes something called a label. What a label is a symbolic name given to a location in a sequence of assembly language instructions. And we'll see some examples of labels here. So to start off with, here what we see is the kind of skeleton of how we realize things in assembly code. We start with a branch. We assume that, say, I is stored in is stored in register $S1, and J is stored in register S2. And what we're going to do is we're going to jump around the assembly code which implements statement 1 if S1 and S2 are equal. So if S1 and S2 are equal, we're going to branch to label 1. And the label 1 will be down here after statement 1. So if these two are equal, we'll jump to label 1, which is where the code for statement 2 will start. So that corresponds with our intuition up here. Here, we're saying, look, if I is not equal to J, do statement 1. But then conversely, if I is equal to J, go and do statement 2. So this is saying, if they're equal, jump to label 1 and go and do the statement 2 code. If we're not going to branch, then we just fall through and execute the next statement after the BEQ, which is the one assembly code instruction, or maybe several, which implement whatever's been expressed in Java up here in statement 1. However, this is not the end of the story, because, of course, after we've executed, if we're taking the what's sometimes called the then branch, the if case, if we're executing statement 1, when we get to the end of this code, we don't want to then execute this statement 2 code. We want to jump straight to statement 3. So the missing ingredient here is jump instruction. So a jump instruction is just a single letter J in MIPS assembly code. And again, we give a label argument to the jump. So this is a unconditional jump. There's no testing whether something is true or false before doing the operation. When you hit a jump instruction, you always do it. So this now is the complete way in which we execute the code. Again, we compare if two things are equal. If they're equal, we're then falling through to the else branch, we jump here, and then we fall through to statement 3. If they're not equal, then we come through to statement 1, and then we jump to label 2, which is the label for the following code. So can everybody see how that assembly language sequence of instructions, the use of the BEQ and the use of the J instruction, the jump instruction, are realizing that Java if-then-else statement? Yep. All right, let's move on. So here we see how these branch instructions and jump instructions are actually realized as bits in a 32-bit word. So again, there's a great uniformity. We always use the upper six bits as a code to specify, or as part of the code to specify what the instruction is. Sometimes, as you saw, we use an extra six bits down the bottom, but we always use these six bits at the top. And so here, if we put the number four in the six bits at the top, the six most significant bits, then we're specifying that we've got a BQ instruction in the MIPS instruction set. The next two five-bit fields specify the two registers that we're going to compare. And then the last 16 bits are used for the offset. So these labels, when you type, they're in their symbolic labels. But what then happens at the translation from assembly code to machine code is the label, or the jump to the label, is translated into a relative change, or it's translated into a number which tells you by how much you have to change the program counter if you're going to make that jump, make that branch. And so this is the calculation here. In fact, you start, after you've looked at this instruction, the PC points to the instruction immediately afterwards. And then if the branch is taken, the address that you jump to is four times the offset. So the whatever number's given here, this offset is a signed 16-bit number. Can anybody give me an answer about why we might want to multiply the offset by four?
Jump by words.
Sorry?
Jump by words.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So the issue is instructions are always stored in memory in an aligned fashion. So when we jump to a new instruction, we know that the address of that instruction will always be a multiple of four. So we know that the lower two bits of the address of that new instruction are always going to be zeros, so there's no point specifying them. So for that reason, when we've got this offset as a number, we always multiply by four, so we make maximum use of the 16 bits that are in that number. Just like there's a branch if equal instruction, here's another one, branch if not equal. So here, if the two registers are not equal to each other, if the values in the two registers are not equal to each other, then we jump to the location in the assembly code with this label. And again, when we go to machine code, this is realized using the assembler itself, that the assembler is the program that translates from assembly code to machine code. It does the actual calculation of the offset number that you need here. Here's the format of the jump instruction. So it uses the upper six bits to specify as the opcode, the operation code, which in this case is two. So number two in the upper six bits specifies that we've got a jump instruction. And then the lower 26 bits are used to help you form the full address that you jump to. Let's see if it gives it here. No. So you might be wondering now, well, there are only 26 bits there, but say even if we know that we jump to an address which is a multiple of four, we still have, if we're working with a 32-bit architecture, we still have a 32-bit address space. So really we want to have, if the lower two bits of the address are going to be zeros, we still want to specify 30 bits of the address that we jump to. However, we only have 26 bits here. So what the decision in the MIPS architecture was the following for the jump instructions. That the architects decided that the address you're going to jump to is built up as follows. So we know the bottom two bits are both zero. Then we've got 26 bits here. So this comes from the instruction itself. And if you do your arithmetic, you'll know that you're left with a question of where did the four bits at the top come from? And the answer is simply that you take these straight from the current program counter. So whatever is the current, whatever the upper four bits are in the current program counter, then you reuse those four bits there. So the consequence of this is that the 32-bit address space is really broken up into 16 zones. And when you're doing these jump instructions, you can only ever jump within one of those zones. And the idea is, by and large, most of the time, all programs are going to fit into a single one of those zones. However, occasionally you're going to want to switch zones. And in that case, there are other special ways in which you'd be able to do a jump to a different zone, change the value of the instruction address in these upper four bits as well. Yes? So if you had BEQ
0 and 0,
if you specified register 0 as the two arguments, it would be like a jump, yes. But the point about a branch instruction is that the distance that you can jump is relatively small. It's specified by essentially assigned 18-bit number.
Because it only has 16 bits
for
the offset.
Exactly, yes. You've only got 16 bits to specify the offset. The offset gets multiplied by 4, but still that gives you only a relatively small range to jump backwards and forwards in code which may be millions of bytes long. So in fact, when you're in a situation where you want to branch quite far in code, then actually what you might do is you might, instead of, if you want to do a branch if equal a big distance, what you might do is instead, so if you've got a BEQ, register 1, register 2 label, and say this label is far away from kind of where this instruction is going to go, then what you might actually do is translate this into two instructions, a branch if not equal, R1, R2, and you might jump just down a little bit to a location here, and then immediately after the branch if not equal, you put a jump to label. So you'll see that the effect that you're desiring by this is achieved by this. So we're kind of switching around from a branch if equal to a branch if not equal. So here we're saying if these are not equal, just skip and continue on. But if they're equal, fall through to this jump and take the jump. So in fact, often an assembler will do this translation for you. This is what we sometimes call in assembly language a pseudo instruction. So the assembler, if it sees you've got a label here which is far away, it will just realize, aha, okay, yes, I can't implement that using a single actual BEQ instruction. So what I'll do is generate two machine code instructions in this pattern, like here. Let's move on. Let's look at loops. So at the top here, okay, we've got a schematic, simple loop in Java. So a single variable, we're comparing it to 0. And we're saying while repeatedly doing tests, seeing if count is not equal to 0, and every time we see count not equal to 0, we're executing statement and then going back to the test again. And then we just go round and round and round until count equals 0, in which case we drop through and execute the instruction following the while instruction. So that's at the Java source code level. At MIPS, this is how we realize that using some branch instructions and a jump instruction. So what we have here, we have a label for the start of the loop. Here what we're coding is the condition for breaking out of the loop, not the condition for continuing. So while this is talking about not equal to 0, here we're talking about being equal to 0. So when register S1, which we say is holding the value of count, when that register is equal to 0, we're going to branch to N. So N's down here after the loop. However, if they're not equal, if the value in S1 is not equal to 0, then we're going to fall through an execute statement, which is kind of like doing the body of the loop. And then when we've finished executing statement, we come through to this jump, and now this is a jump back to the start of the loop, to the test again. So hopefully you can see fairly clearly that this pattern that you see at the top there is indeed realizing that while loop. Down the bottom of this slide, we've got another example. Here, what we see is a condition which is a bit more complicated, where we're doing two tests. We've got two Boolean variables, flag 1 and flag 2. And only if they're both equal to true are we then going to continue the loop and execute statement. And then when we're finished with statement, we're going to come back and test them both again. And if again they're both true, continue. But if either one is false, then we're going to exit the loop. Again, when we're realizing that in code, we're going to invert the logic a bit. We're going to code the assembly language instructions such that they're picking out conditions for when we're going to break out of the loop. And so what we'll do here is we'll code the tests of the two flags, flag 1 and flag 2, by two branch instructions. And what we'll do is we'll assume that S1 holds the value of flag 1, S2 holds the value of flag 2. And we'll assume, say, that a value of 0 means false, and a value of 1, or non-zero, so any non-zero means true. So here, when we do BQ register S1, 0, branch if S1 is equal to 0, what we're doing is we're saying, let's branch if S1 is false. Branch if count is false. And where do we branch? We branch to end. We branch to just after the loop. So we're saying, break out of the loop if count is equal to 0. Sorry, flag 1 is equal to 0. And similarly here, we're saying, you know what? Also try to break out of the loop if flag 2 is 0. However, if you get down here, then we know that both flags are non-zero. And now let's go and execute the assembly language, machine language instructions, which correspond to the body of the while loop. Then after we've executed these instructions, let's just jump back to the beginning of the loop and do the tests again. So you'll see how this high-level statement is realized by this down here. Are there any questions about that? All right. So sometimes for doing comparisons, what we desire is not to, we desire to do the comparison, but then we want the value of the comparison in some register. And that's what the following instruction does. So this is called set if less than. And so what it does is it compares register R2, the value in register R2, with the value in register R3. And if the value in R2 is less than the value in R3, then it sets the value in register R1 to 1. Otherwise, it sets the value in R1 to 0. So this statement here is really kind of, it's realizing at the machine code assembly language level, it's realizing a statement like that, or something like that, that you might write in Java. It's computing the Boolean value of the test on two arguments. So for example, if we wanted to code this while loop here, we're now here we've got a greater than test, we can make use of this set less than instruction. So let's assume that I is stored in register S1 and J is stored in register S2. We're going to use a temporary register T0 here to store the value of the comparison. So we're going to ask if S2 is less than S1, or J is less than I, or I is greater than J. So this test here is exactly the same as this test up here at the Java level. So we're doing that test, and we're storing the result of that test in register T0. And now we're saying, look, if T0 is false, if the value in T0 is equal to 0, then let's break out of the while loop. Otherwise, we know the value in T0 corresponds to true, the loop condition, loop continuation condition is true, and let's execute the body of the loop. And again here we've got the jump that takes us back to the beginning of the loop. Does that make sense? Any questions? So in the I told you on Tuesday, hopefully some of you have gone there and had a look. There's a lab on the website, which is it's a kind of self-guided lab at this stage, where they kind of take you through using a simple MIPS simulator and get you to run and execute and try to write some very simple MIPS programs. And so you should be able to now to code some very simple MIPS programs, using the knowledge that you're acquiring today and that you acquired on Tuesday. And I encourage you to do that. In some time, probably end of next week, I'll have a proper assignment for you, which will be then assessed. You'll have probably a couple of weeks to do the assignment, and there'll be an assessment at the end of that. There'll be a hand at the end, and we'll mark your work and give you a grade on that. And so that will be a further opportunity to practice translating from Java or something like Java down to assembly and writing assembly language code. But you can get started on that now. You don't have to wait until that practical is issued. I strongly encourage you to do that now. You're very lightly loaded now. You probably haven't got too many assignments in other courses, and this would be an ideal time to get stuck in and give that a go. All right, let's move on to method calls, or function calls if you're working in a language like C. Let's look in Java. So in Java, so we've got some very schematic Java code here. We've got a method called foo down here with some body, not saying what it is. At the end, we've got a return statement. And then up here, we've got some body of code which has two calls to foo. And the issue, so if we're implementing, one thing we might try to do is implement calls and returns using some kind of jump instructions. And what we're exploring now is the nature of those jump instructions, what properties they need to have. So you can imagine certainly that a method call, when we come down through the Java code and we come to this instruction here, at the assembly language level, we could realize the call to foo simply by a jump to the start of the body of foo down here. And similarly, when we come to this one, we could realize the call to foo by another jump from this position in the corresponding assembly code to the start of the code itself, which implements foo. So all well and good for calling a method. The crunch comes, though, when we're implementing the return statement. So the key thing about when you're returning from a method is you go back to where you came from. You don't always go back to the same place. So when you've executed this call foo, this first call, and you've gone down here, you've executed the body, and now you execute return, you're going back to here just after this call. You're not going back to after some other call. So what should be coming clear to you is that we need a bit of memory here. When we're making a call, we have to remember where to go back to afterwards. And we'll see shortly how to do that at the MIPS level. That's coming right here. What we use is a jump instruction called JAL, that stands for jump and link. It does two things. Firstly, it does a jump to label, just like the J instruction, but it does something else. It saves the value of PC plus 4, so the value, the address of the instruction following the JAL instruction, it saves that address in one of the registers, a register that's usually given name RA. So we're saving the address of where we should continue on from after we've done the method call, after done the body, executed all the instructions, which form the body of the method that we're calling. So that's when we make a jump into a method, we remember in this register RA where we should go back to when we've completed that method. Then when we come down to executing a return, we use this instruction called jump register. And what this does is it sets the program counter to the value stored in a particular register. In this case, if we specify R1, we're going to the value stored in the register R1. So if we did JRRA, we'd use the JAL instruction here for jumping into the method, then we could use JRRA to return from that method back to where we want to return, which is just after that call to the method, just after the jump that realized the call to the method. I know it's a little bit subtle. Are there any questions about this? Is this making some sense? Up there. Aha, next slide. Any other questions? All right, so very good question. So if we've got a call within a call, this basic scheme is not going to work exactly as is, because what's going to happen is the second method call is also going to use its register RA, and it's going to overwrite the value stored in RA on the first method call. And so we won't have enough memory. We won't know when we've come out. We'll come out of the second method call okay, but we won't come out, won't know where to go back to after that first method call finishes. So we've got to do something a little bit more clever, and that's going to come up. That comes up on this slide. So what we imagine here is we've got three fragments of code. One fragment of code where we've got a call to some procedure A, some method A. Within method A, so this is now method A, within method A, we've got some call of method B. And then within method B, we've got some call of method C. So here we're seeing three nested calls of methods. And what we do is every time we do a call, is we use a stack data structure to remember where we should go back to. So let me double check. Did you all did stacks in first year? Yes? So you remember stack is this, I see a shake. Okay, so are there some of you who didn't do stacks? Okay. So what is a stack? A stack is it's a very common data structure in computer science. And there are a stack is it's a sequence of elements. These elements could be bytes or words, or they could be whole objects in Java. And a stack always has a top, and it supports a couple of operations. One called push, and one called pop. And the push operation takes an argument. Say we'll just do a stack of numbers, and say we could do something like push 5. What a push does is it adds whatever you're pushing to the top of the stack. So So if we did a push of 5, we would say this is the current top of the stack, say there's something in there. So we've got numbers 7, 3, 9, 1, 4. So we've got numbers already in the stack, and we do a push of 5. After that push, 5 would be the new top of the stack. And we could do another push. We could do a push of, push of 12. And if we did a push of 12, we'd add a 12 to the top of the stack, and the new top would be there. A pop is the opposite operation to a push. A pop gives you back the top element of the stack, and then moves the top of the stack down. So if we did a pop on the stack, the pop would return 12 as a result, and now the new top would be here, and essentially this top here would be forgotten. If we did a pop again, we'd pull off the 5, we get the 5 returned by the pop call, and now the new stack would look now like this again. So that's the idea of a stack. It's a sometimes called a last in, first out data structure. The last thing that you're pushing in is the first thing that you pop out. So that's the concept of a stack. And so what we'll do is we use a stack data structure in memory to store these return addresses. So every time we do a call, we'll have a special stack which will remember addresses, remember return addresses. And every time we do a call, we'll push the return address onto the stack. So that's shown on the right here, this picture here. Now stacks, here I drew a stack growing up the board. When you're implementing stacks in memory, you can decide whether, as you go kind of up the stack to the top, this is actually an address increasing, or whether going up the stack is having decreasing addresses. Over on this slide, what I show is a stack which has increasing addresses as we push items on, because as I said before, half the pictures you see have addresses increasing as you go down, half of addresses increasing as you go up. Here we've got addresses increasing as we go down. So as we push items onto this stack, actually, I should fix this slide because, sorry about that. This arrow should correct this in all your slides. For this code to be correct, this arrow should point upwards, not downwards. So addresses are growing up, and as we're growing the stack, we're putting data entries at lower and lower addresses. So when we push, as we make these calls, call A, call B, call C, and we're saving the addresses just after call A, just after call B, just after call C, then we're pushing those onto the stack as kind of A, B, and C here. And then when we're wanting to returns, what we do is we pop the top value off the stack. So when we've made the call to C, procedure C, and we've finished procedure C and returning from it, we look at the stack and we take the address we should return to here, we pop that off the stack, and we return to this call C code. Eventually we pop the address just after B and return there. Eventually, we pop the address just after call A and continue from there. So that's the idea of using a stack. So instead of just using a register, we're going to use a stack data structure in memory to remember a sequence of return addresses. And then we can have our calls nested within each other as deeply as we want, as long as we've got space for this stack. Question? Okay, so in practice, what you would do would be to reserve certain parts of memory for a stack. And then there might be some hardware that would ever detect if you were trying to write off the end of the stack and would cause an interrupt or something, would cause the execution of the program to break. Where sometimes, if you've been executing programs with loops, especially, say, these functional programs, you might have seen these stack overflow messages. I don't know, did you ever see those in Haskell? Well, a stack overflow in Haskell is where you've done some recursion in Haskell. You've got repeated method calls again and again for so many times that the stack has, that the memory for stack has been exhausted. So that can happen, and there are ways in which you detect that. Okay? All right. We are pretty much out of time. Let me say, just say, that this code down here is a something. So we have a register called SP for stack pointer. And now this code here is implementing, so stack pointer is a register which is giving you the address of the top of the stack. And these two instructions here, the add immediate, which is decrementing the stack pointer by one word, and the store word instruction, these two together are implementing the functionality of a push. And these two here, this load word and add immediate, are implementing the functionality of a pop. So hopefully from what I've told you already, that will be clear. All right, I'm going to stop there. There's one more slide, and I'll finish that slide start of next week on Tuesday. But you've certainly got enough now to go off and give that lab a try. And either do it in the DICE labs here, or just download the MIPS simulator and try it on your machine at home. I strongly encourage you to do that. And remember, too, to prepare for your tutorial next week. Thank you.
Sometimes you also need to push on the stack the local variables.
That's the last slide.
Oh, okay. So I guess we'll see that on Tuesday.
Yes. Oh, well, so we're still in the process of setting up the supervised labs. So we won't be allocated to particular labs, but we'll have times through the week when there'll be demonstrators in the labs, and you can just drop in when you want to. Okay.
Why it's two zeros there. Oh, because we always store instructions in a line fashion. So instructions are four bytes. So we know the address of any instruction always has two zeros on the end. So when we're specifying a jump instruction, we never have to specify those bits because we know what they are. Well, we know that the address of any instruction we jump to is always going to be multiple of four, because the instructions are always stored in an aligned fashion in memory.
So why is this like 60 bits?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why are these 2 bits here and not after?
Yeah. Okay. Show me the slide again. Yeah, no, sorry, that's right. So in instruction, there are 32 bits. We always use the other 6 bits of instruction to specify what the instruction is. So that means we've got 26 bits left over to specify where we're going to jump to. And then the way in which we use those 26 bits is as follows. We kind of plug them into the middle 26 bits of this 32-bit word. We plug on 2 zeros on the right-hand end, and we take 4 bits here from the current program counter, we use those for the upper 4 bits of the address we're going to jump to. So we're wanting to calculate a 32-bit address, which is the address we jump to. Now we create it from these three components, which are coming from different places. This is coming from the program counter. This is coming from the instruction itself. And these are all zeros.
Okay.
I just heard you say that you wanted to change this diagram later, so I think there's a typo on the save word line. It should say save RA on top of stack.
Oh, right, yeah, that's a typo as well, yeah.
So yeah, I just wanted to
Okay, thanks.